Welcome to Murder with the Misses. I'm Darren.
And I'm Amy. And today we have our daughter.
Hello, hello.
That's Haley. Today we're going to talk about Saturday Night Live alum. They have been known for their comedy for going on 49 years now, given as comedians like Eddie Murphy, Tina Fey, Chris Rock, Adam Sandler, Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, Andy Samberg, Jimmy Fallon. The list goes on and on. But there have been some tragedies throughout as well. There has, of course, been some deaths of cast members since they have been doing this for so long. Notably, Gilda Radner, who died of ovarian cancer in May of 1989. Sadly, a lot of people today don't even know her name, but she was a very funny lady. And she was married to Gene Wilder, the OG Willy Wonka. More recently, you have Norm Macdonald, who passed away in September of 2021 after battling cancer for 9 years. Most do remember him because his death is more recent and the fact that he was in a lot of Adam Sandler movies, but his news reports on SNL really were hilarious. This story is going to be about three specific deaths that rocked Saturday Night Live cast because it shows the sad side of comedy along with true crime, which is what we're here for. We start with John Belushi. Most will remember him from movies like Animal House and The Blues Brothers back in the 70s and 80s.
That's how you described him to me, so I knew who you were talking about. He was the other Blues Brother.
The other. Everybody knows Dan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all I could think of because John died so long ago, most people your age don't even know who he is. But John's first big break was on Saturday Night Live. John, Dan, and Chevy Chase were OGs. They were season one cast. Sadly, John developed an addiction to alcohol and drugs. Dan even said that they had a budget on the Blues Brothers movie for cocaine to help them get through night shoots. He said that everyone on set did it, but John really fell in love with it. He said, "Everyone did it, including me. Never to excess and not ever to where I wanted to buy it or have it. But John, he just loved what it did. It sort of brought him alive at night. That superpower feeling where you start to talk and converse and figure you can solve all the world's problems."
He suffered from depression and fell into drugs and alcohol to cope. So he started to party a lot.
Yeah.
And they even said that, I mean, he did some of his best acting.
While high, yeah.
While high, I mean, Animal House. And,
well, yeah, because there are those over-the-top, yeah, wild comedies where you've got to be, you know, committed.
He married his wife Judy in 1976, and she lived in New York. So while she knew that he had his addictions, she wasn't fully aware of how bad they had gotten by 1982. At this point, he was 33 years old and staying in Los Angeles trying to get his career back. He was working on a script for a romantic comedy, but it wasn't going well. At this point, he had a limited attention span, incoherent speech, his clothes were dirty, and his personal hygiene was going downhill. He was staying in a bungalow, and it was reported that this became a common stop for friends when the clubs closed at 2 a.m.
Yeah. On March 4th of 1982, he spoke to Judy, and she said that he sounded more frustrated than depressed, but she could tell he was out of control with his drug use. He called his dealer. He also visited his manager and asked for $1,500 in cash to buy a guitar. His manager said no, because he would just use the money on drugs. But it didn't take but a couple of hours before he handed over the money anyways. Robert De Niro and another actor friend came by the bungalow that John was staying in to try to get him to come to dinner. They said that John and his dealer were there, and the room was trashed with empty wine bottles, dirty laundry, and pizza boxes. John refused dinner, but the two said that they would stop by afterwards.
They ran into Robin Williams at the dinner. He was actually performing because this place was also a club. Robin said he would also stop by John's whenever he was done with his set.
Yeah, and he did do that and said that the room was in the same state as Robert De Niro had said. Robin did a little cocaine with John and said that John had complained about feeling sick. Robin talked to him for a little while before leaving. De Niro did stop by on his way back through and said it was sometime after 3 a.m. He would go on to say that John and the dealer kept injecting themselves with cocaine mixed with heroin, which that's known as a speedball. John had been complaining of chest congestion, but was finally sleeping when breakfast was delivered to the bungalow, and the dealer is the one who signed for it. His dealer said that she checked in on John at around 10:15 a.m. before leaving. She took the syringe and spoon they had been using so that the maid wouldn't come across it when they came to clean the room. It was around noon that John's physical trainer and part-time bodyguard came to the bungalow to drop off a typewriter and tape recorder that John had asked to borrow to write the script he was working on. He found John in bed and not breathing. He did perform CPR, but it wasn't looking good, so he called John's manager. The manager's secretary is who called 911. The manager then headed over to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, because that is where they would be taking John, but sent his assistant to the bungalow. When he got to the bungalow, the trainer was still doing CPR and was crying, saying, "John's dead." The ambulance did arrive, and John was declared dead. The coroner's office did say that his death was caused by acute cocaine and heroin intoxication.
They said there was enough of it in his system to kill even a healthy man, which he was not.
It's a sad fact, too, that even though people were obviously concerned about him that night, seeing him like that wasn't out of the ordinary at this point, so no one felt like it was cause for, like, immediate concern.
Yeah, so he was so far into his drug use that this was a common, I mean, just, if I walked in and saw somebody like that, I'd be like, oh my God, he needs help. But them walking into it, it was just like, oh, that's John, being John.
Yeah, and it sucks because he was so great.
He was so good. He was good. But the autopsy report also showed pulmonary congestion, which distended lungs, and he had a swollen brain and enlarged liver and obesity. The dealer was questioned and released, but went on to do an interview with the National Enquirer saying that she not only supplied the speedballs, but she had also injected John with them. So she was then charged with murder and drug-related charges. She pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter and three of the drug charges and was imprisoned for 15 months. She even did an interview with Rolling Stone saying, "I know I'm the last person who saw him alive. I know what he did in the last 24 hours. It was just the Hollywood scene, really. Nothing out of the ordinary." And how sad is that?
Years later, in 2015, Rolling Stone voted John the greatest of all the SNL players.
He beat out Eddie Murphy, Bill Murray, and Tina Fey.
Yeah, he was something else. But this goes into another tragic death of a big fan of John Belushi's, and that was Chris Farley. He was big on SNL, too. He was spotted doing improv by Lorne Michaels, who's the big dog over at SNL. And Lorne really thought that Chris had exactly what they needed on the show. This is where the friendships came about with Adam Sandler, David Spade, and Chris Rock. And he did a lot of movies with his friend Adam Sandler. Adam is known to keep his friends close and make sure that they have parts in most of his movies. Chris was over the top. He was a wild comedian that did anything for a laugh. A big main role for him that most people remember is from the movie Tommy Boy.
We have a friend that used to remind us of Chris Farley because he could act just like him. And
yeah.
Whenever he would show up at my house, Dad never called him by his real name. He always called him Chris.
Well, they resembled each other and they acted the same and just the comedy style was the same. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually know a guy that is the same exact way. He acts like him, looks like him, always cracks us up with that type of stuff. And it's just because they're over the top funny and always a good time.
Always a good time. That's good stuff. And that's definitely a Chris Farley. But behind the scenes, he was doing everything to excess, including partying and living a similar lifestyle to John Belushi. He was out of control, but people close to him said he was a very sweet guy. Before midnight. But it is said that there were troubles after he did the infamous Chippendales skit on Saturday Night Live alongside Patrick Swayze. Chris Rock has said, "Chippendales was a weird sketch. I always hated it. The joke of it is basically, we can't hire you because you're fat. I mean, he's a fat guy, and you're going to ask him to dance with no shirt on? Okay, that's enough. You're going to get that laugh, but when he stops dancing, you have to turn it in his favor." And that's not what happened. Rock said There's no turn there. There's no comic twist to it. It's just fucking mean. A more mentally together Chris Farley wouldn't have done it. But Chris wanted so much to be liked. That was a weird moment in Chris's life. As funny as that sketch was, and as many accolades as he got for it, it's one of the things that killed him. It really is. Something happened right then. As Chris moved on to the movie industry side of things, he was still lacking. He told Rolling Stone, "This notion of love is something that would be a wonderful thing. I don't think I've ever experienced it other than the love of my family. At this point, it's something beyond my grasp, but I can imagine it, and longing for it makes me sad."
He would go on to be in and out of weight loss centers, AA meetings, and rehab, 17 stints. Stints?
Stints, yeah.
17 stints in rehab, to be exact.
Yeah, he went into rehab 17 times.
In the 1990s, he would go on benders, using heroin and cocaine. Adam Sandler would tell him that he was going to die from that and tell him he had to stop, that it wasn't going to end right. Chevy Chase used some tough love, saying, "Look, you're not John Belushi, and when you overdose or kill yourself, you will not have the same acclaim that John did. You don't have the record of accomplishment that he had."
Yeah, they saw him going on the same track, but they really were different levels. I mean, they acted the same with the wild over the top, but they were still very different. He would go on to have a four-day binge of booze and drugs. He was at the club Karma, partying until 2 a.m., then brought it back to his apartment. The next night, it was the 38th anniversary party for Second City, followed by a pub crawl. The next day, he spent his time with a $300 an hour call girl, who said all he wanted was for her to give him cocaine more than anything else. She would go on to say, "I don't think he knew what he wanted. You could just tell he was on a rampage. He just kept bounding from room to room." On December 18th of 1997, the fourth day of that binge, at the age of 33, which is the same age as John Belushi at his death, Chris was found dead. His brother found him in his Chicago apartment entryway, wearing only pajama bottoms.
With his death, though, there were no drugs found in the apartment, so it took weeks for toxicology reports to find an exact cause of death.
Right, so of course the immediate speculation was drugs and alcohol, but some also said it could have been heart failure or choking to death. The toxicology report was a deadly overdose of morphine and cocaine, so the speedball. He died at the same age and in the same way as John Belushi. But Chris also had a narrowing of the arteries that supply the heart muscle, and he had antidepressants, antihistamines, and marijuana in his system as well, but they did not contribute to his death. What was not in his system was alcohol.
In 2017, David Spade posted on Instagram, "Heard just now it was Farley's birthday today. Still has an effect on me and lots of people around the world. It's funny that I run into people now that don't know who he is. That's the reality of life moving on, but it still shocks me a bit."
Yeah, because like this was one of his best friends, and he's been in so many movies and, like I said, the Saturday Night Live stuff, so you would think that he would have more infamy than that, but there are people who do not know who he is, and it's so sad, because we still are fans of Chris Farley. He was just funny, and there's no telling where his career could have gone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes when we watch Adam Sandler movies, which is a lot.
A lot.
I mean, you can't help but wonder, like, how would it have been different if Chris was in it, you know, like in Grown Ups or any of those, you know?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Just imagine, like, the level of
comedy.
Comedy if he was in there with them, you know, Kevin James and all them. I mean, that would put it over the top. They're good and great like they are.
Oh, they're good. Yeah.
It would just elevate it for sure.
Exactly.
That would just put it over the top. I mean, like, it's perfect.
And I was reading, because I'm a weirdo and sometimes I go off on tangents, and Adam Sandler is worth somewhere around like $440 million right now. But I think if Chris Farley was in his movies, he'd probably have more than that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, well, but Adam Sandler, though, I mean, he's been grinding.
He's been at it for years. Yeah,
he's been grinding for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, but like most of the movies that you've seen with Chris Farley was always usually David Spade.
Well, yeah, but he was in, like, Billy Madison.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not saying he wasn't in.
But he had smaller roles, yeah.
I'm not saying he wasn't in Adam Sandler movies. He mm-hmm. was.
Yeah, smaller roles.
But you've seen him. I just remember him more with David Spade. I think they're still all Happy Madison Productions.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, but.
But, yeah, that was his main guy.
Yeah.
They were all friends, but he made a couple of movies with David Spade where they were, like, the main people. And so they were kind of branched off on their own, which is what you want. But mm-hmm.
they were kind of like a powerhouse team. You knew yes. if they were in a movie, it was going to kill.
If they were in a movie, we were going to watch it.
Yep.
Just how it is. Was it Black Sheep?
Yeah.
That one wasn't even a very good movie, but I'll watch it.
Yeah. Well, it was just like we bought that one Adam Sandler movie in Walmart.
Oh, People.
And I'm not even going to say the name of it because it was it's got to be one of his first ones. And I was just like,
wow.
We bought it and we was like, it's got to be good. It's Adam Sandler. And got home and we was just like, well.
You got to start somewhere, you know?
But it did not steer us away from Adam Sandler at all. I mean, we still watch him and everything. I was just like, you know what? It's one. Come on.
Yeah. And like I said, you got to start somewhere. He was very, very young. And it just wasn't up to the level where he's at now, or even when he was doing Billy Madison and Big Daddy and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Like, you can just watch his progression. And now that he's this big powerhouse by himself, he's just coming out with.
I like a lot of I like a lot of his serious movies, too. I mean,
I do not as much.
I like them.
If it's got Drew Barrymore in it, I'm giving it a 10 out of 10. I don't care.
Dad, too.
I don't care, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm the Blended fan right there.
I can't tell you how many times we've watched Blended.
Anyway, let's get off. More than this too much.
This brings us to the true crime portion of the podcast, and that is Phil Hartman. He had a different style of comedy. He was more of what I would say was deadpan or dry. Like, he could stay serious and straight-faced while everyone else was laughing their asses off. He was a shy person, and he was actually a graphic designer. But one night, he was in the crowd at a performance by the iconic Groundlings troupe in Los Angeles, and he volunteered to go on stage. The founder of the Groundlings said, "I never saw an audience member come up with that kind of excitement and energy. It was like a hurricane hit the stage, and I mean, in a good way." So he joined the troupe and started traveling. But they also realized that he was a great writer. He helped create Pee-wee Herman's character and co-wrote the screenplay for Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which is a trigger for me because when I was little, we tried going to daycare and they played that movie on repeat every day. I don't remember ever watching anything else. But luckily, he went on to Saturday Night Live starting in 1986.
He won the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Writing for a Variety, Music, or Comedy Program for SNL in 1989. He was the voice of actor Troy McClure on The Simpsons, and he did shows like News Radio. He was also in movies like House Guest and Jingle All the Way, but in his personal life, he was not as successful. He was married from 1970 to 1972 to his first wife. The marriage to his second wife was between 1982 to 1985. His second wife would say, "My sense of Phil was that he was really two people. He was the guy who wanted to draw and write and think and create and come up with ideas. He was the actor and entertainer, and then he was the recluse. He was always looking for something new, fresh, and had an idea for beauty." He met a model, Bryn, after they met on a blind date in 1986 and were married a year later.
When he told one of his friends from the Grounding troupe, they said, "Oh God, no," and Phil and her would not talk for years after that.
Yeah, everybody around him could see that Bryn was no good for Phil. And so he's like, "Hey, we're getting married." And they're like, "Oh God, no. Please don't do that."
But when they're in it, they don't see it. It's really like an after kind of thing.
It's them blinders. Yeah, mm-hmm. You get them blinders on. But that shows that people saw the issues. Bryn and Phil would have two kids, their son Sean and a girl named Bergen. But the relationship between Phil and Bryn was dysfunctional. They would fight and break up regularly. Brent had a bad temper. She was jealous and she had a cocaine problem. His second wife wrote a letter to the couple congratulating them after Sean was born. And Brent wrote back, "Don't ever fucking get near me or my family or I will hurt you. I never want to hear from you. Never, ever, ever come near us or you will really be sorry." So it sounds like she has anger issues too. In fact, Phil had told people that he had to restrain her before. So what they would do is get into a fight and then Phil would go to bed and let Brent cool off. He told someone, "I go into my cave and she throws grenades to get me out." Brent was going in and out of rehab in late May of 1998. On May 27th of 1998, she went out to dinner with a friend and had some drinks. When she got home, a fight started between her and Phil. They reportedly were fighting over a previous altercation where Brent had hit their daughter while she was drunk.
He threatened to leave her if she got back on drugs or hurt the kids again. Then Phil did what he does. He went to bed.
Went to bed. Now, Brent drank some more and did some cocaine. They had a small collection of guns, and at around 2 to 3 a.m., she took a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson from the lockbox and shot Phil multiple times in the head and chest as he slept. He died instantly because one of these shots was between the eyes. Brent drank for another hour or so and then called a friend. She said that Phil was gone and had left her a note saying he would be back later. So the friend just told her to go to bed. But 20 minutes later, she was knocking on that friend's door. She came in and collapsed on the living room floor. He thought she might have overdosed, so he quickly woke her up. He said she made a beeline for the bathroom and began puking, but was repeatedly saying that she'd killed Phil.
She even had the gun with her, but the friend didn't believe that she had actually done that.
Yeah.
She sobered up a little and asked the friend to follow her back to the house, which he did. She called another friend on the way and told her the story, and this friend took her seriously. So Bryn and the first friend make it to the house and go upstairs where the friend sees Phil. He called 911 at 6:20 a.m. Her other friend arrives when the paramedics arrive. They take Sean, who is 9 at the time, and Bergen, who is 6, and get them out of the house. Sean told the cops that there was a door slammed over and over again. He was talking about the gunshots. Bryn had locked herself in the bedroom with Phil's body and called her sister. When the cops banged on the door for her to let them in, she hung up the phone and shot herself.
Yeah. He was still on the show News Radio at the time, so they wrote his character as having a heart attack, and his friend, John Lovitz, filled in for the fifth and final season of the show. So, there are three tragedies, in my eyes, from the SNL cast. It's sad that these people that we see as happy, funny, like, go-get-em people who just want to make other people smile are suffering so much on the inside or dealing with so much in their lives, like Phil. And we say it a lot. You never know what someone is dealing with.
Yeah.
But I know that to this day, there is no telling what these three people would have put out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, had they, like, I mean, cleaned up.
Just imagine the movies, the skits, everything. Everything. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. Everything was just over the top. Just over the top.
I agree.
These guys.
In a good way.
Yeah.
If you or someone you know suffers from suicidal thoughts or emotional distress, please call or text any message to 988.
All right. Well, that's it for this one. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Catch us on the next one.
Bye.
Bye.